You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, September 6, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report, and we are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, live from the bowels of the DNC in Charlotte, North Carolina, the great Kevin Baker and the great Jack Hitt. They're on assignment writing for Harper's Magazine. Also, I think calling into the program later in the program, Dean Obadella. Tell us about his Muslim comedy tour. I think he's running for vice president. I don't know what is going on with that. We will check that out. Also on the program today, of course, last night, Bill Clinton's speech, Elizabeth Warren's speech. I'm still thinking about how bad Rahm Emanuel's speech was. I think so far could be the worst speech of the entire convention. At least that was, you know, after 6 p.m. at night.
Probably the worst speech of both conventions.
Could be. Also on the program today, somebody got their panties in a bunch. I guess AIPAC upset that with the Democratic platform. And so, of course, President Obama immediately calls for a change. Not that dramatic of a change, back to 2008, I guess, but what are you going to do? Oh, and God is back into the platform. Thank God. Some good news on a Michigan Supreme Court ruling. We will talk about that a little bit later in terms of unions. But this story I wanted to just start off with. Just a final nail in the coffin that was the Republican National Convention. Apparently, according to Pew Research poll, the public paid far less attention to this year's Republican convention than it did to the convention just 4 years ago. Just 37% say they watched all or some of the Republican convention, down from 56% in 2008. I don't know what you can glean from that. Maybe it was because they didn't announce the vice presidential candidate at the convention. Maybe it's just because no one likes Mitt Romney. But my favorite part of this poll was that despite the fact that there apparently was a tiny little bump in some people saying that they think that Mitt Romney is now a human being now as opposed to a Cylon, which is to be expected. The highest number of people, the plurality of people saying what was the highlight of the convention was not Mitt Romney's speech, not Paul Ryan's speech, but indeed, it was Clint Eastwood's speech, performance piece. I'm not sure what you would call it. 20% named Clint Eastwood's speech as the highlight. 17% said Romney's speech. Republicans, even amongst Republicans, he barely beat out Clint Eastwood. Independents said that Eastwood's speech was like 8 points more than the Romney speech. So, as such, just a brief programming announcement here. We're going to be doing the rest of this program for now on, where I just simply will be talking to a chair. So there it is, me just talking to a chair. It's not necessary I'm in camera for this. I don't even know why I'm using a microphone. I'm just talking to a chair now. We're going to take a break, and the chair will, of course, interview Jack Hitt and Kevin Baker, who are live at the Democratic National Convention.
Hello, Majority Report listeners. This show is being sponsored by StrangeAngels.com. It is a progressive online dating site where you actually work with people to hook you up with other people. And they are fans of the program. They're supporting the show. And they are actually sponsoring 50 free trial memberships to the Majority Report lasting 1 month. So you can get in on that by sending me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and use the word strange angels in the subject line. In the meantime, head over to strangeangels.com if you're looking to meet someone, you want to go through a process that is not run by machines, but is actually run by people. And even if you are have already been lucky enough to find that special someone, you can go over there and actually help be a volunteer to match people up. It's an amazing, progressive way of doing online dating. And these people put their money where their mouth is. They want to support the show. That's why they're offering those free trials. So check it out. StrangeAngels.com. Go visit them today.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome the dynamic duo that is reporting and blogging on the Democratic National Convention for Harper's Magazine at Harper's dot, what is it? Dot com, right?
Dot org.
Sorry, guys.
We're an org.
Okay, so, Jack, let's start with you. It is day three now. It seems a little bit different than the Republican National Convention.
Well, yeah, no, this is a very, very different convention. First of all, it looks so much different. I think, I don't know, people just here seem to be a little bit more party-centered. You know, I don't know. They're just walking down the street, people seem to be having a much better time. And maybe that's Charlotte, which is, you know, a place full of great barbecue joints, and the street is filled with vendors, and there's practically like a kind of Mark Twain 19th century atmosphere here. You know, people peddling all kinds of puppets and, you know, posters and buttons and everything else. There's food everywhere. There's, you know, there's even like little company stands, you know, Verizon, all these vendors, with, you know, people here are selling stuff. In Florida, it was just, you know, once you were inside the containment area, there was just very little that wasn't absolutely controlled. And it seemed to be, you know, if it was joy and pleasure, it was held at private events, and you didn't really witness it on the street.
I would agree with that. You know, Charlotte has a little bit too much of a kind of Stanford modern city thing going on, but it's at least a somewhat human place. As opposed to Tampa and the convention there, which seemed like a really bad Club Med on the put on the edge of a third world country. This kind of fenced off area next to something that looked like it could have been come out of the Rogue Warrior movies, you know.
Interesting. And so, all right, well, give me a sense of like what Put this in context as to 2008. I mean, I think I've been a little bit surprised at just sort of the, I don't know, the excitement in the hall there. It seems, I guess I anticipated a little bit more sort of, maybe I was just projecting a little bit more ambivalence.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it has been surprisingly exciting. I think the delegates here, the party in general, are amazingly forgiving of all the sort of betrayals that have come out of the Obama administration in the last 4 years. You know, the kind of the trope is always in the mainstream media that the Democrats are this incredibly disorganized and fractious, rebellious party. And that really hasn't been true for a generation, you know, not really since 1980. Everyone really generally falls in step behind the candidate, and that's what's going on here now. They're very gamely, very enthusiastically getting behind President Obama.
Jack, are you surprised by it?
Yeah, you know, I wrote an email to some friends almost a year ago saying, like, you know, this campaign is going to be a race between people on the right who hate Mitt Romney but nevertheless recognize he's going to be the nominee. And we'll have, you know, very little sort of like enthusiasm for the candidate versus all of the people on the Democratic side who are now, you know, unenthusiastic about Obama's, like, just sort of like serial betrayal of everything he ran on in 2008, right? Well, now we're here and we see how that enthusiasm is playing out. I mean, I thought in Tampa all of the enthusiasm for Mitt was absolutely pro forma. You know, they knew they had to clap when he came out. Paul Ryan obviously got a real enthusiastic response. They really like him. No one likes Mitt Romney on the Republican side. We all know this, right? It's why they lurch from Herman Cain to Donald Trump to Sarah Palin to Rick Perry. Everybody had their turn at first place because they were all just trying to find somebody, anybody, right, who wasn't Romney, right? I mean, this is the man that John McCain loathes, the man who he would refuse to appoint as his vice president in 2008. And yet, there was John McCain, you know, sort of going through the paces, saying all these nice things about Mitt Romney. Here, though, I have to say, like, for all the disappointments, here are all the constituents of the Democratic Party, you know, women's groups, you know, unions, all the different groups that essentially, if you look at the actual, policies that he's pushed through or not pushed through, have been betrayed on some level over the last 4 years. And yet, somehow that all has dissipated in the, especially around the Michelle Obama speech. I mean, that was an amazing, she did an amazing ability, I think, of taking her own personal relationship with her husband, their own personal relationship with their children, and their own personal relationship with this country, and weave them into an amazing sort of single declaration of love, really. That was the word she used over and over again. It's really interesting. Her and Ann Romney both seized on the same theme. But I thought she did a much better job of bringing all of that together into a single kind of, not just a speech, but just like a moment. The way she held that room with those, with her lines were amazing.
I mean, it seemed that Ann Romney was talking about that theme in service of trying to humanize Mitt Romney, and it seemed to me that Michelle Obama was talking about it in an attempt to sort of show how Obama is connected to other people, not her, even.
Right.
I mean, the speech was pretty amazing. Let's talk about last night, Kevin. What did you make of? I mean, you know, what struck me was, you know, and I didn't think Elizabeth Warren's speech was the. I love the content of it. I mean, I think, you know, she's obviously not as polished at giving a speech in a room like that, like Bill Clinton. I don't know if anybody is, but what struck me was, They were almost, I mean, at the very least, Elizabeth Warren was almost an indictment of much of what Bill Clinton stood for, it seems to me.
Oh, sure. You know, and here again, you see the loyalty. I thought it was a very good speech, actually, particularly for somebody who's an amateur. And I thought it was amazingly generous to President Obama for somebody who was basically kind of given the back of her hand by this president and his and his, you know, troika of advisors there, who I've taken to calling the three bozos of the apocalypse, you know, Rubin, Summers, and Geithner. But, you know, after going through all this, she was amazingly generous to him. But, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, you have to remember how this party has been essentially wiped out twice now in the last 18 years by the self-serving and wrong-headed missteps of Presidents Clinton and Obama. And they're still cheering for them out there on stage. You know, I mean, you have the 1994 election when both the presiding generation of Democratic leaders and all the kind of seed corn was annihilated by the catastrophic Clinton, you know, midterm. And then you had the same thing, you know, often because of the same unlearned lessons in 2010. And yet people are still out there cheering. And I think a key reason for this is, as much as anything that that Clinton said, was that big bear hug at the end. You know, and this reminds people, this is what the Democratic Party has brought us. You know, this white man from grew up in rural Arkansas, hugging this black man with an African father and from a mixed-race marriage. This is that sort of America that has come about, as opposed to a Republican Party, which still will not tolerate anybody going before them, as Condi Rice demonstrated, and saying which side was right in the Civil War.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jack. I mean, you know, like this convention, I would have never guessed even a week ago that this convention was going to be so oriented towards social issues. I mean, I knew it would be oriented towards social issues, but I didn't know it would be so oriented towards social issues, so oriented towards identity. It seems like this is almost like the culmination of sort of the dilemma of the Democratic Party in some respects. I mean, it's working in this instance, but it is the dilemma, at least from the perspective of people like myself, who want to see the Democratic Party get back to a place or become a vehicle again for economic justice for as many people as possible. And it seems like they've been able to almost short of the Warren speech, completely sidestep it.
You know, well, the sad, I also think, like, what's not being said at the Democratic convention is really breathtaking. And Kevin and I have been talking about this. We don't quite know what to make of it yet. But, you know, have you heard about Osama bin Laden here?
Right.
No.
Yeah,
no one mentions that. You know, we ended, you know, our military pretty much has ended the scourge of piracy, you know. You don't hear about it. You know, I mean, all sorts of, like, he ended the war in Iraq, right? I mean, and then, of course, is the war in Afghanistan, also unmentioned. But, you know, good, bad, and whatever. I mean, it's amazing that there's no national security component to the defense of Barack Obama at this convention. It's, yeah, you're right. It's absolutely, it's all social issues and economic issues.
Well, what do you think, Kevin, you can answer it if you want as well, but what do you think? Why do you think that's the case? I mean, it's simply because the Republicans didn't really make make their own sort of national security case. So why should the Democrats bring it up?
Well, they sort of did. And in doing so, they left a huge opening because their own national security case was so downright idiotic. You know, constant criticisms of Obama for not telling us where he stands on Syria without suggesting any place you should stand because they don't dare to back one side or another. You know, constant criticisms, a constant talking point was America should never lead from behind off some anonymous quote from an Obama administration official saying that's what we were doing in Libya. No refutation of that, saying like, yeah, that leading from behind ended up with Muammar Gaddafi with a bullet in his head. You know, it's just in general, the same talking points Jack's talking about. There's been a little of that from the not on primetime speakers, such as Harry Reid, but it should be a general theme. You know,
Joe Biden will probably do that, right? I mean, won't Joe Biden be the guy? We saved GM. We killed Obama or whatever it is.
Yeah, we killed Osama. Yeah, like Bin Laden dead.
And Osama.
Yeah, exactly. Saved GM. Killed Osama Bin Laden. Killed Gaddafi. And the war in Iraq. I mean, there's been a, actually, in many ways, a stunning series of successes, you know, in foreign policy for the administration. But for some reason, they're not willing to engage on that. I think it's a mistake.
It's a total mistake. First of all, the Republican attacks on Obama in Tampa were bizarre. I mean, Condi Rice, I mean, her entire critique of Obama is that he's not speaking clearly, and yes, and the leading from behind business. But, you know, that was her criticism. He's not being clear. We need to be absolutely clear. That's what they all kept saying.
McCain, do you think anybody even remembers Condi Rice? I mean, look, I'm looking at the Pew Research Center poll, just coincidentally, I mean, honestly, about the RNC highlights. And yeah. I'm looking at the highlight, the GOP convention highlights, as mentioned by anybody paying attention to the poll. And it goes literally in this order. Clint Eastwood, Mitt Romney, Ann Romney, Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio, Condoleezza Rice comes in with 2%. Nobody even remembers that she was there. You know, as soon as Clint Eastwood came up and spoke to a chair, it was like nothing happened before then, and maybe barely something after. And my sense is you'll get Joe Biden talking about this, but I don't know. Do you get the sense that maybe this, convention, more so than conventions in the past, at least, in recent past anyways, is more almost geared towards the Democrats and the base of the Democrats than sort of the so-called middle and, moderate Republicans? I mean, I get the sense that this is really about, like, we're going to mobilize our people.
I think that's it. The Nielsen ratings of the Republican convention came out a few days ago, and Mitt Romney had like a third fewer viewers than John McCain did in 2008. It's really just plunged. I suspect we'll find the same thing is true of the Democratic Party next week. Although if it's not, that'll be interesting because typically these conventions are pitched to this is the first rollout of your guy, right? This is the whole idea is that you have this narrative that culminates in the heroic descent of your man, Mitt Romney, Barack Obama, right? But it doesn't seem that they're functioning like that way anymore. First of all, the networks have cut way back, but even the hours that are on the air, it's not clear that anyone but the true believers are watching these shows anyway.
But what? I don't agree with that. Jack, I'll tell you why I don't agree with that. Because when you say this is supposed to be the big rollout, right? To start the narrative of Mitt Romney is our, descending from wherever and Barack Obama's. Well, I think that still exists. In fact, I think the narrative coming out of these two conventions is going to actually be stronger and more sort of defined than I've seen in recent elections myself, because it's really just the media in the first place. Right. It's really just the media that makes the narrative. They're the ones telling the story. And this was so we've got one more night, but I have a feeling that, Barack Obama is not going to come out and trip on himself and give a dismal speech. I mean, it's sort of almost like a foregone conclusion that I don't think I've seen such a stark difference between conventions. And I'm speaking as someone who, again, has so much ambivalence that to the extent that, I've had more trouble watching the DNC than I did the RNC because I felt more cognitive dissonance in watching the sort of like just the ecstasy in Charlotte than the sort of the moroseness in Tampa. But I'm still just struck by, I think coming out of the RNC, the media finally said Paul Ryan is a joke. And whoever was responsible for setting this up, i.e. Mitt Romney with Clint Eastwood, has no idea what he's doing. And then, after the past two nights
but
of the GNC,
You're making my point. The ratings have plunged. The only people watching are the true believers. And many of these fact checkers went after Paul Ryan. But guess what? They're still saying what he said. They're still making the claim. That's because the moderate voters haven't really tuned in yet. I think it used to be this was when you pivoted out of your insider talk, your conventions, I mean, your primary talk and all that stuff, to this larger audience. But I don't think that pivot is going to happen now until, like, practically October.
Yeah.
You know, I would say, I think you have a good point with that, Sam, although I don't think it's by any means a foregone conclusion that Obama will give a great speech tonight. He could easily go into one of his sort of oddly diffident doldrums, which seemed to overtake him at different times, and come up short. But beyond this, I think a lot of this enthusiasm relies upon a great deal of denial by the rank and file. You know, I went and interviewed a whole bunch of these of the delegates yesterday, both on the floor and off, and they are just an amazing amalgam of Americans. I mean, this is really the most diverse, multicultural, multiracial gathering of people you'll see anywhere. You know, they're terrific people. They're terrifically good-looking. They're handsome, you know, professional, accomplished, et cetera. But they, one of the ones to ask them was, what do you see happening in a second Obama administration if he is elected? And they're completely delusional about this. They think it's going to be some just like moving to the left, completing and nailing down things like health care and job creation and improving education. And they're not really paying attention to any of the talk in the commentariat and in the Obama administration about this grand bargain on the budget that will cut Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits and probably up the retirement age. You know, they're just not, I mean, whether deliberately or not, they're just not paying attention to any of that. And I think there's going to be kind of a rude shock coming if Obama is reelected. But I think that's what's keeping the peace for now.
There's a lot of that, like he's the real Obama is actually going to come out in 2013,
yeah.
And finally he's going to be unshackled. Is that the theory?
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. I asked him, how is this going to happen? Like, assuming that he has these liberal urges, which I think is a big assumption at this point,
right.
What's going to do this? And the answers are just completely absurd. A couple of them say he'll use more executive power, but most of them really think either Democrats will sweep both houses and or Republicans will come to their senses and realize they've got to, you know, just govern in the best interest of the country and we'll all go along to get along and, you know, we'll just make everything better. And this is just, you know, I mean, Mitch McConnell was just out once again. Mitch McConnell, the human ferret, was just on the air again saying the other day how, like, you know, we are not going to cooperate, period. Forget about it. You know? And it's still like they won't hear this at all.
Jack, do you think that, like, the country is, like, in this sort of, like, national, you know, like almost like this like shock. I mean, it seems to me like you've got the Republicans are completely deluded as to what a second Obama administration would look like. And the Democrats are completely deluded as to what a second Obama. And it's just like, I just remember as a kid playing Frisbee. I was running backwards and I ran into a tree. And the guys I was playing Frisbee with said, like, I literally stood there stunned for like 5 seconds that I had hit a tree and then I just collapsed on the ground. And I feel like there's this national sort of moment where we just sort of like, you know, run off the cliff and nobody realizes that there's no ground underneath. And, I mean, what is going on down there? Is it just like what happens when you go south of the border? It's something like you... Well, I guess you're not south of the border. You're in North Carolina. I mean, it's just.
I think there is some glimmer of hope in that. Did you catch this guy? Murdoch is the Tea Party candidate who's running, and now that he's the nominee, he's pivoted away from the Tea Party and is now saying that what we need is bipartisan solutions. And I think he's only saying it not because he believes it, but he's hearing from the voters. That, you know, 4 years of just inaction in the middle of a recession is not acceptable. And even, you know, I think both Republicans and Democrats, whether they'll act on it or not, or get past their own self-interest and gaining power by frustrating the other side, but especially the Republicans who now have made this like the primary platform plank of their party, whether that's going to actually change or not, I don't know. You know, I was talking to this guy, Dick Harpootlian, who's this very famous Democrat down in South Carolina, where I'm from, and he was saying that, you know, if Obama really wanted to make his second term work, he would campaign in like the Claire McCaskill district and basically challenge Todd Akin and say, will you say publicly that you will work with me and compromise with me in the new term, or will you join your party's chorus of, you know, frustrate Obama on everything? Will you reject everything that I bring up in the second term if I win? And make those candidates say now whether they're just going to be, whether they're going to be Mitch McConnellites or whether they're going to, you know, do something like what John McCain used to do.
Well, I guess my problem is, though, is that I'm quite convinced that if these people work together, they're not going to do anything to benefit the economy. I mean,
exactly.
That's my fear, is that they're just going to go ahead and say, well, now we can agree to cut Social Security and Medicare, and we'll cut government spending, and, and then in 3 years, I guess we will, we'll Osborne this whole thing and try it again.
I'm hoping for stasis. I'm hoping for stasis. That's my best hope for a second. I hope the Republicans stick to their guns so nothing disastrous gets done. I think that's our best hope for the next 4 years.
No, I agree with you. I mean, my biggest concern now is that David Koch the other day said, I'm open to tax increases. I mean, to me is like that's the scariest thing I've ever heard, because this guy owns half of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
I blogged about this the other day, but let me just say to all of your Republican listeners, Sam, there will be a stimulus package if Mitt Romney becomes president. This is the really big lie of the Republican convention, because Mitt Romney's already signaled that he's going to do it. He's even said it. You know, earlier this year, he mentioned stimulus spending as a necessity, and then immediately, like, shut up when he realized that wasn't flying at all. But, you know, if you look at his little plan, which is not very elaborate, but there it is. I mean, he's got a whole energy component and a huge defense component. And that's how Republican stimulus plans often work. You know, Eisenhower passed the National Defense Interstate Act, right? They push their stimulus programs through the Defense Department. But there will be stimulus spending, because Romney knows more than anybody. The economy will never get off its back until we put money in the hands of consumers. And right now, the only lever we have to pull is government spending. There'll be an excuse for why we can't fix the deficit this year, next year, whatever it is. Just like under Cheney, right? Deficits don't matter. That's what he said, right? And into the deficit spending we went. That will happen again. That will happen again that Romney is president, because there is no other way that he can pretend to win second term unless the economy turns around.
Are you making an argument that we should be voting for Mitt Romney?
Well, no, I think Jack would agree that stimulus program will be called Invading Iran. You know, and that's the problem with it.
Right. Well, I mean, let me ask you this. Do you get a sense from the delegates there? I mean, were people talking about this in the building anyways? Because, you know, I saw a little bit of discussion about this, but not much. The dichotomy between Elizabeth Warren and Bill Clinton.
The dichotomy in what sense?
In the sense that Elizabeth Warren is basically indicting all of, you know, everything she was indicting was Bill Clinton, was the essence of what Bill Clinton is. I mean, everything else is just sort of commentary in some respects.
Sure.
Are people conscious of that? I mean, the people who are watching these speeches, did you get the sense that there was this level of awareness that, like, you know, when Elizabeth Warren says this thing is rigged, and then Bill Clinton later talks about how, you know, welfare reform worked. And, yeah, there's a little bit of deregulation, but we need to work on the deficit, and we need to have constructive cooperation. I mean, isn't the definition, when Elizabeth Warren says this thing is rigged, isn't the means in which it's rigged via the constructive cooperation?
Oh, sure. I mean, to give you an analogy here, Sam, you know, somewhat like yours, you know, I mean, and I love these people to death, you know, these delegates. I just love them. But they're kind of the equivalent of, you remember the old Phil Hartman, John Lovitz sketch on Saturday Night Live, where Phil Hartman would go in as a patient and John Lovitz as a doctor, and Lovitz would say, you know, I'm going to give it to you straight. You know, you've got 6 months to live. And Phil Hartman would shake his head and say, like, I don't know, Doc. I just don't understand all that medical jargon. Tell it to me in plain English, you know. And this would go on for like 5 minutes. I mean, this is sort of the thing, you know. You have the DLC dominated, at least in ideology, if not official membership, but the DLC dominated elite of the party, which has been signaling for the last, you know, couple of years that they're planning, that their big hope for a second Obama term is to reach a probably disastrous budget compromise. And, you know, the rank and file are just refusing to get that word. They just think the second Obama term will be all about, you know, increasing Pell Grants and funding clean energy. You know, and I think this is going to lead to a huge disillusionment at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Bill Clinton up there talking about Simpson bowls. I mean, it's just sort of... I guess the upshot is that there'll be I don't know, more listeners to this program, I guess, you know, come early January, you know, we would retitle it to the Disillusionment Hour or something.
I think there's nothing like winning that really spurs grand revisionism on a former president. I mean, Clinton looks better now in this room than he's ever looked in the history of his entire political career.
Definitely.
I mean, the guy is the Ronald Reagan of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, he can rock that room. But remember, you know, Reagan was equally a disappointment to the Republicans. He raised taxes 7 out of 8 years. Newt Gingrich hated his guts, attacked him constantly for kissing up to the Russians. You know, but when it was all over, he was Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And now this guy is Bill Clinton. I'm telling you, these guys are going to want to put his face on Rushmore in 5 more years and chisel him on a nickel. I mean, you know, it's amazing how much they love this guy, even though the policies that he supported when he was in office pretty much go against all the constituents in this room.
And how long ago was it? I mean, you know, the amazing thing is that Clinton's up there talking about the arithmetic of Paul Ryan's budget. Am I the only person who remembers that that Clinton was on tape going up to Paul Ryan going like, listen, buddy, if you need some help,
you know,
let me know, because you're getting, you know, this is not right.
You know, you're not the only person who remembers, that kind of encouragement of him backstage when he didn't think he was being filmed.
Yeah.
Telling Ryan to, like, go ahead and, you know, do this. Well, and I think that's the trouble. Something I was writing about Reagan the other day when I was writing that Romney, if elected, could make his policies work in the short term. And it'd be disastrous in the long term. I think that characterizes the Reagan administration, and I think to a certain degree it characterizes the Clinton administration. Nice housing boom while he's in office, fantastic, we're all getting rich, great, and then, you know, he's out of office and we realize Glass-Steagall no longer exists. You know, this is, unfortunately, what has become the modern presidency. And
Chris Hayes actually had a very astute observation last night where he said, you know, when you look at Bill Clinton and you know, maybe when you look at Bill Clinton, you think of the legacy of Bill Clinton. So much of what he did, I mean, during the 90s, it was, you know, the big economic boom and whatnot. But so much of what he did, the legacy of what he did, ended up being problematic. Welfare reform. Communications, 96 communications bill, Glass-Steagall repeal. So much of that has been problematic, not to mention the loss of essentially both houses of Congress. You know, his legacy is not now, whereas Obama, to his credit in the past 4 years, to the extent that he's had any legislative achievements, I would argue that on a civil liberties way, there is sort of a bad legacy that's going to be there, but not so much on other accords. I mean, I think, you know, the worst that can happen with the Affordable Care Act is it doesn't bring the death of the insurance industry quite soon enough. But I think that there's a certain inevitability to that.
I from your lips to God's ears, but, I find it frightening, for instance, how willing he was to completely sell out on the budget and actually adopt Laffer-Curve philosophy, in 2011 in trying to reach this grand bargain. He was going to agree to massive tax cuts for the wealthy and have them not made up by anything but the presumed business activity that would create. He was swallowing the entire Republican philosophy, hook, line, and sinker, and doing it in this very quiet, calm way. You know, that would have shattered the party right there. And I find these people, you know, quietly terrifying in their way. How little devotion they have to anything but themselves, you know.
Is the phenomena of deifying Clinton, is that just sort of like a natural? I mean, that seems to happen to every president once they're out of office, unless they actually still continue to, unless they actually tack to the left in some respects. You know, like Jimmy Carter seems to be more of a leftist to the extent that than he was certainly in office. I mean, you know, I guess it's hard to measure because he's, you know, policies, but he's not enacting policies, but it almost feels like there's this like huge amount, this like this mass of national love out there that just can't quite settle on anybody who can actually be in a position to do something and disappoint them. So Bill Clinton is sort of like a safe repository for that.
I think he also comes off tremendously well as being somebody who enjoys politics. You know, I get so tired of the modern politician who obviously so doesn't enjoy being out there. You know, Bill Clinton gets up, and he's just going to give this big, leisurely old speech. He's going to just play with it. He's going to have fun. He's going to ignore the primetime, you know, deadline of 11 o'clock. And he's just going to do what he wants to do. He loves this. And I get, frankly, annoyed after a while with people like, you know, like President Obama, like, you know, like Mitt Romney, whatever, who, you know, for whatever reason have decided to become president to pad their resumes, but don't like politicking at all. You know, I mean, love the game or get out of it. And I think that's what some of his appeal is.
Yeah, let me, hold on, we just lost Jack. Let me see if I can just get him back on for a second.
Okay.
Hold on 1 second.
Oh, Jack, we don't need Jack. What the heck?
It's probably true. We really don't need him, but we'll try.
just cut him right off there. Oh, Jack.
No, he's not there yet, but we can pretend like. No, the conversation's going much better without Jack. Oh, we'll wait till he gets there. Jack, did you get offended or something by what Kevin was saying?
I'm always offended by what Kevin Baker has to say.
I understand.
About deification, as they say, like, remember how, you know, quickly Harry Truman became, you know, the give him hell Harry, and, you know, I mean, so many of these presidents, you know, arrive at this sort of new status when they leave office, but some of them don't. I'm not sure. I mean, Jimmy Carter said this tiny little bit of rehabilitation, but, you know, they still parked him in the, you know, the outer precincts in terms of this time slot at this convention, right?
Well, I mean, Jimmy Carter has continued to be sort of, I mean, has not melded to the conventional wisdom. I mean, he's been pretty open and honest about what's going on with Israel. He has been far more aggressive in you know, telling truths than, say, Bill Clinton. You know, Bill Clinton just comes out and just goes, I love these guys, but they're bad at math. Meanwhile, you know, I'm going to go and make $400,000 speaking to, you know, one of the world's greatest monsters, who is a dictator of some oil company. I mean, you know, who knows? You know what I mean?
Here will be the real test of American revisionist history. Will George W. Bush ever in our lifetime be rehabilitated as a great Republican president?
Well, it's funny that Clinton made the first move toward that last night by lauding him for his policies and trying to help famine and disease in Africa. And, you know, it's the one thing George W. Bush deserves some credit for.
Yeah.
Right, but I think to get deified, you need something bigger than what, you know, like, you know, Jimmy Carter had a couple of good things that he could point to. But, you know, the overall tenor of this
George
time,
Bush just, gave you know, to charity. Okay, great. And he took a plane trip.
Now, he probably did save millions of lives. That was a good thing. But as Clinton was, you know, the funny thing last night was you had more past Republican presidents mentioned in a laudatory way by both Clinton and by Elizabeth Warren, who lauded Teddy Roosevelt, than you had, I think, in the entire Republican convention. You know? I mean, if you watch the Republican convention, you would have thought, presidents before Barack Obama were John F. Kennedy, for some reason, and Ronald Reagan. And last night, Clinton got in every Republican president after 1933, with the exceptions of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, and said very nice things about him.
Well, I'm quite convinced that all you need to do is say the words George Bush. It doesn't matter what comes before or after it. It has the same effect in terms of the efficacy in getting people to loathe Republicans. But that's just my own personal theory on that. All right, guys, so anything else that we should know at this point? Have we left anything on the table or what?
Jack?
No, I just say that every one of these speeches has produced like some really amazing line, and I think the line last night that still rings with me is Clinton's description of the Republican race at this point, which is that we made a mess of everything for 8 years. This guy didn't clean it up fast enough, so fire him and bring him back in.
Right.
Yeah, that was a great.
The guy can really nail it. Yeah,
that was a great thing in a nutshell. And he really got across how absurd a lot of these Republican charges are, which is another reason why they love him. And again, I think there's a certain desperation behind all the unity and the enthusiasm. I mean, after watching the Republican convention, I was about ready to charge out there and volunteer for Obama again and give him money again.
I don't know if people can fully appreciate how dramatic the idea that you would say that's a fairly dramatic statement, I have to say. I don't know if people can fully appreciate that.
I mean, that was my emotional charge. Right. Well, I had been a huge Obama supporter originally, and then, you know, 3.5 years of betrayals, and I not so much. But these people were so loathsome in Tampa. You know, they're so disgusting. They're delusional. Their every idea for the country's future is so horrifying that all this Ayn Rand / Catholic Church of the 13th century, whatever incoherent nonsense is so terrifying that, maybe the smiles at the Democratic Convention are desperate hope, for something better than that. I mean, to elect Mitt Romney and give the Republicans total power would be an act of national suicide. And I think the fear of that happening is maybe what drives a lot of this new Democratic enthusiasm.
Well, on that note, guys, thank you so much. Always appreciate hearing from you. And, of course, we have a link up to both of your work on harpers.org. Great stuff. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Dean Obadella. You can become a member of this program at majority.fm. All right, well, let's just take a quick musical break. We'll get Dean on, then we'll go to the better half of the program. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report, and on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Dean Obadella. Dean, how are you?
Great, Sam. Thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. Where are you? You in CNN right now? What are you calling me from CNN?
I'm in the Time Warner complex. I broke through security. They don't know I'm here, and I'm infiltrating as part of the Muslim Brotherhood, CNN. This is part of my Michelle Bachmann plan that she caught me on. No, I just did something on Headline News, which is the sister channel, as you know, to CNN, so they're here. So I had that, and I'm really happy to come on here and talk
What are you doing? Are you running for vice president? What?
That's my tour, Dean Obadella for vice president. Because first of all, everyone wants to be president. Second, this is more consistent with my personality. I'm not an alpha male. I'm a beta male. I just want to come in second place. I don't want to be third place. Don't get me wrong, Sam. I like second place. And also, vice president's a great job. I mean, you get paid $230,000 a year. You do almost nothing, and you're treated like a celebrity. It's like being a Kardashian. And not even like Kim, like one of the other ones. I don't even know their names, the ones without the sex tape, like one of them. Like, it's really a great job. I'm not even kidding you. It's priceless.
Well, now, wait a second. What party would you run on?
I'm sorry?
I mean, are you affiliated with a party, or am I taking this one step
too far?
Oh, no,
it's just comedic. It's obviously comedic. No party would have me.
Wait, it's not real?
The last name, it's not real. With the last name, I go Bidal. I have the word Allah in my last name. Which party? If there was going to be a party, it'd probably be a Democratic Party.
So you're going on a comedy tour right now?
I am. 8 cities, my friend. Starting out this weekend in Portland and Seattle, 2 liberal bastions, especially Portland, very well known as a liberal bastion. And then going to Boston and D.C. and Chicago and back here, finishing up in November back here. And it's just, you know, it's in San Fran and Sacramento as well. And it's really fun. I mean, it's progressive political comedy. If you like progressive comedy, you're going to like it. If you're not progressive, you're going to hate the show. I'm going to be blunt with you. Don't even come. Don't waste your time.
Yes.
Watch Honey Boo Boo.
I send an email to someone like that almost on a daily basis. They write in and they're like, they have a complaint about the show. And I'm just like, you know what? It's just not for you. Go away. But
you're never going to change your mind. We know the idea of the cognitive dissonance. There's certain people, no matter what you say, what fact you give them, you can't get through. And I'm a little bit like that on certain issues, too. You're not going to change my opinion, but I'm amazed some people will watch me, or I'll write an opinion article for CNN, and they go, that was all opinionated. I'm like, it's the opinion page. What part don't you understand? This is what I'm writing. I'm writing an opinion. They go, you're a journalist. I'm like, I'm the furthest thing from a journalist you'll ever meet. Every week I write an opinion article for CNN, and they're on the opinion page. And they're outraged, conservatives, outraged by me writing liberal opinions. So.
You know, I think we posted on the site your YouTube. Hold on, let me see what this is. It's your comedy tour video.
Trailer.
And the Dean Abadala for Vice President comedy tour thing. And my favorite part is just sort of like, all of a sudden it's like you're doing stand-up and a mom. Is that where it is? Where is it?
Jordan, yeah. I produced a comedy festival for 3 years in Jordan, and we had comics of all backgrounds, and it ended like 2 years ago because the mayor who championed it resigned and then got arrested. So that's always a bad thing. That happens in the Middle East sometimes. You know, people are in power and then they're out, and you don't retire. You go to jail, essentially, a lot, or you get dethroned or you die. That's the option. It's like the mafia.
It says, Dean Abadala, comedian, courtesy Amman Comedy Festival.
Yep.
I don't know.
Monster that, Comedy Festival.
We had
some great comedy. We had Gabriel Iglesias and Russell Peters in it. And it was very diverse. It wasn't like an Arab festival. It was comics of all different backgrounds. Even Jewish comics. We had everything. You know, it was really a showcase. They wanted it for tourism. And it went great for 3 years, like 5-6 nights every December for 3 years in a row. It really was fun. And stand-up comedy in the Middle East has really taken off. I was just in Kuwait a couple of months ago. I've been in Egypt many times, Lebanon, Jordan, Muscat, Oman. I did 2 shows in Saudi Arabia in the last couple of years. It was a lot of fun. I opened for a beheading, one of them. That's a tough gig, but, you know, the people wanted a laugh before the beheading. So that was kind of nice.
Have you been watching the Democratic Convention?
Of course.
What are
you
saying?
Sam, I'm like you. We have to watch it. What can you do? I mean, do you think it's wrong at the end of the Clinton speech to bring out all the famous people like Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp and Ken Starr for like a real world reunion? Would that have been too much?
That probably would have been. That probably wouldn't have been.
I would have loved that. That would have been a fun moment for me.
Yeah, that probably would have changed the tenor of the speech, I would imagine.
That would have eclipsed the Clint Eastwood thing, though. That would have been what you know. But the best thing is today people are talking about the content of Bill Clinton's speech and not him talking to an empty chair after Mitt Romney gave, you know, his speech, and yet Clint Eastwood upstaging him. So this is really, you know, not even being partisan, honestly. I mean, they've done a great job these first 2 nights.
Yeah, I've just found the production to be just significantly better. I mean, even just the idea. Now, it occurs to me now that the Democratic Convention, the stage is at one end of the arena, as opposed to in the middle of the arena. I mean, I'm not sure. I got to double check on that with the Republican, but just the camera work itself was better. I don't know. It was strange. The whole thing is just
it's much warmer. I mean, if you go look at the stills, because I was comparing yesterday, you look at the stills for the Republican convention, the backdrop behind Paul Ryan and Romney was this gray as white thing. The Democrats, they've used some really smart people. It's a much more colorful, it's much more warm colors, and that makes a difference. It has an impact on you. And also the crowd, what a difference. I don't just mean excitement. I mean, the Democrats, The delegates, they look like the face of America. The Republicans look like the early bird special crowd at Cracker Barrel. I mean, it was really – I don't even care. They have a few minorities they showcase. You know, how many times can we see the same handful of people? The party self-identifies 90% as white. Nothing wrong with white people. Just because I'm American, I don't have any problem with white people. That's not my point.
Some of your better friends are white people.
Some of your better friends are white.
Let's not get carried away.
Right. I like how you put that. Absolutely correct. But it really – the Republican Party is going to go the way of the Whig Party if things don't change for them. And they know that. And it's, you know, in 2048, I think most people know the minority will be the majority in America if everything continues demographically. And the Republican Party is not ready for that. And the Democratic Party is so suited for that. And it's really going to be, they're going to be left behind, the Republicans, if this continues.
Yeah. The question is, who is the Democratic Party going to be leaving behind? I mean, I think, in some respects, I'm in a rather jaded mood at the moment.
Neither party's for everybody. I mean, you don't have a specific, I think, point of view and perspective on issues if you appeal to every single person. It's like a comic who, if you kill every night, they're probably a hack, let's be quite honest with you,
right?
Because it's so hard to make people laugh every night with every joke you do. If you have a point of view, the more unique you are as a comic, and I'm not analogizing it, I'm just a comedian, that's all I know, but the more unique you are, the more challenging you are. I think political parties, more unique you are, the less people fit under your tent, hopefully on your philosophy, not on your view of race and religion and ethnicity. I mean, that's a problem with the Republican Party. I mean,
right.
If you're – look, I'm not saying they're racist, but if you hate Jews or blacks or Muslims especially or gays, which party are you going to feel more comfortable in? It's the Republican Party. You're not going to feel comfortable in the Democratic Party if you hate gays and Muslims and minorities and immigrants. It's just not going to be a good place for you, and you know
that.
Well,
tell me, I mean, my understanding is, at least in the past, you know, at least prior to like 2001, my sense was that the Muslim population in this country was predominantly, maybe not overwhelmingly, Republican. Is that the case?
Is that still
the case?
It was. No, you're absolutely right. Before 2000, before George Bush, Muslim Americans I knew, and your listenership is, you know, they know the difference, but, you know, I even say it on CNN, Arab and Muslim are not the same. Ethnically, Arabs, there are more Christian Arabs than Muslim Arabs in America. 60% of Arabs are Christian. But the Muslim population, which is a little bigger, about 3 to 5 million, definitely are socially conservative on certain key issues. And it changed, though. Once Bush got in and the war in Iraq and the backlash after 9/11, and the use of Islam and Muslims as a way to divide people and motivate voters, it moved almost all the Muslims I know and all the Arab Americans, Muslim or Christian, to go to the Democratic Party. And some like Ron Paul a lot. I mean, a lot this year were supporting Ron Paul because they like the libertarian thing. But I think also the population, especially the young Muslims, have become more liberal on social issues as well. So I think it's a combination of the way the Republicans have used Muslims as a card to divide people and motivate their base to hate. And you see it still with Joe Walsh, the congressman who's running against Tammy Duckworth. Chicago said horrible things a few weeks ago, saying Muslims are laying in wait here in our district. He went to the town, Elk Grove, you know, Elgin, they're right here. And then within days, a homemade bomb was thrown at an Islamic grammar school in his district, headstones at a cemetery with a face with anti-Muslim graffiti. You know, there's a consequence when people make that, and we all see it within our community. We have emails, Michelle Bachmann, of course, saying horrible things. Alan West saying horrible things. You don't see Democrats saying that. So the message is clear. We're not welcome to that party. It doesn't matter if you're a rich Muslim or not. You're just not welcome to that party.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, is there within, like, the Muslim community, is there that thing of, like, we've got to lay low? I mean, I would imagine, you know, like, I sense it less in the Jewish community than it used to be. I mean, as a little kid.
What was the thing? It was a dress British. Think Yiddish?
It was right Yiddish, cast British was the sort of the way that they used to do TV and theater at the time. It was right Yiddish, cast British, but it was also like, you know, like, don't make any waves because you don't want to stick out, and you know, that's, it's less so, but I mean, there was a lot of that when I was a kid, you know, 35 years ago, there was still another generation or two of older Jews who had that sort of philosophy because they, you know, they were a little worried. Is that happening in the Muslim community? Is it something that's actually grown more?
I think it's gone. I think right after 9/11, and I can tell you from a personal story, and this is not a joke, this is true. After 9/11, the first time I went on stage was at Stand Up New York, and the manager of the club, not the owner, was a friend of mine, and said, I don't think you should use Obidala on stage. because you know I have the word "all" in it, and someone can give you problems, and people are beaten up, and he's trying to help me. And I actually went on stage for the first 2 weeks after 9/11 as Dean Joseph, using my middle name.
Wow.
And this is completely true. So there's no comedy in there. And I didn't even talk about being Arab before 9/11. I really identified much more strongly just as a white guy at that point, part of the majority, like the Majority Report, but part of the majority. And afterwards, I realized I'm not, because when you're defined by your worst examples in America and a handful of examples of that, at that, then you're not a white person. You're part of a minority. And so after 9/11, a few months later, for months, I didn't talk about my heritage on stage. And then after that, I realized I need to. I need to show people a different side of who Arabs are, that we're here. We look like typical white people, a lot of us, frankly. I'm mixed. I'm half Italian, but I still look like what people assume as a white guy, not as an Arab. And I think the community, I sort of paralleled the community's feelings. We went from being very insular and being afraid and circling the wagons to understanding that we must get involved in politics, that we must speak out, we must go on television, we must be involved in the media. So to me, the offensiveness of Michelle Bachmann saying Muslims in the government are part of the Muslim Brotherhood, to me, is so greatly offensive, because we know we have to be in the public, in politics, to have an impact on policy. And she wants to keep us out of the system. And to me, that is one of the lowest things that's why it so angers me. Joe Walsh stuff is different. Joe Walsh saying, oh, they're going to kill us. We've heard that. You know, we can deal with that. Last time they had the statistics, they released 14,000 Americans were killed or murdered in America, 2010. Zero by Islamic fundamentalists. Zero killed by Muslims. Killed by what are the faith of the other people killing Americans? We don't bring that up. It's not for us. But there's never anything talked about honestly. It's just used as talking points. So, I think now we realize there are now a record number of Muslim American delegates at this convention. There's 55 Arab American delegates at this convention, the most ever of all different faiths. Less so when you just have Muslims, but it's the most Muslims. I saw women with hijabs on some of the audience shots. So, we're getting more and more active, and I think you're going to see more Muslims run for office. There are already some Arab American congressmen. There's two Muslim American congressmen, Keith Ellison and Andre Carson. I think you'll see more. And that sound you heard shrieking was Michelle Bachmann screaming in the background. As I said, there'll be more Muslims in politics.
That is, an interesting sort of that it's made Muslims more aggressive about getting out there and getting into the limelight in some respects. I mean, it's interesting.
You have to. The stakes are so high, Sam, because we're being defined by people outside of our community in the worst ways. Sometimes they have an agenda, sometimes they're ignorant. And we realize we have to tell our story in the entertainment field, in the media, and in politics. And we have to get involved. And a lot of times we talk about this, and, I'll be honest, overwhelmingly, Muslim Americans are not walking around having any problems with Jews. In fact, they emulate them now, saying, look what the Jewish people have done. They're a small number. They've gotten so active in the media and in politics that we must follow that example.
They do almost all the podcasts.
And they what? I'm sorry.
They do almost all the podcasts.
You control the podcast. You've given up on banks and the media, but now the podcasts are all yours. You're devious. Yeah. That's how you take over. You, Mark Maron.
Yeah.
Who else is out there?
I'm sure there's others. Doing a podcast.
There's at least three.
There's got to be at least
or four.
Three.
And there's no Muslims that I think doing a podcast. I have a blog that doesn't count. I have the Dean's Report. And if I could, by the way, my website, in case anyone would like to go to my comedy tour, if I can say it. I'm not sure if there's any rules here in your show.
Yeah, no, you can.
DeansComedy.com.
We don't ever say any web addresses on the show. We just don't. We're not buying into this internet thing.
You don't know. You know WBAI here in New York. I used to host a show once a month on it. You couldn't plug anything. You couldn't say ticket prices. You could say a website, but there were limitations to whatever you could say.
What show was this?
On WBAI, here, on Pacifica Radio, because it's all listener sponsored, so they couldn't do anything commercial. You could say your website, but you couldn't say.
Wait a second. Are you charging for your tour?
My show?
Yeah.
I did a tour where we did shows for free. This one I have to because I'm trying to pay bills. I'm trying to stay off the streets.
Okay.
That's not a story you want to see. Muslim comedian on the streets of New York.
Right.
That's not really an effective jihad.
All right. Yes. You can say your website. We have it at majority.fm as well. But
all right. Thank
Dean
you.
Abadala,
Dean of comedy.
Right?
Dean Obidala, that's right. Sam, the first time I ever went on the radio almost any kind of political thing was you, your show.
Oh, really?
Janine wasn't there the day. I mean, I remember very well. I came in, we pre-taped something, and something got lost in the pre-taped, and I had to come back and do it again. And then I was on a few times with you and Janine live.
Yeah, Chris Hayes told me the same thing.
Did he?
Yeah.
He's done very well.
I think Taibbi as well.
Mike Taibbi?
Matt, I think.
Oh, Matt Taibbi.
I think Matt was the first time
Matt
was on the show. I'm not sure.
I know a guy named Mike Taibbi. Like, why would he be on the show? But how have you been enjoying the demo? Have you guys had live reporters from the DNC?
Yeah, of course. It's not like, look, this isn't...
this is huge.
This is not a low-end operation here. I mean, it is a low-end operation, but phones are pretty relatively cheap. Although I didn't get a phone. I did it on Skype, so Skype is even cheaper. So.
And tonight's the big night. What do you think? A bounce? Any predictions? Have you talked about this? I hate to bring up stuff, but I'm...
Oh, what?
I love politics.
Will there be a bounce? Oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think, like, the biggest thing coming out of this will be this sort of just, I think, the perception of the establishment media and the way they cover the rest of the campaign based upon what just took place, which I think will favor the Democrats. I mean, this is a particularly difficult time for me because I'm watching a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for something that I'm not so enthused about. I got much more excited at making fun of the Republicans than I am sort of cheering most of the Democrats I've seen. I mean, there's only really been a couple of Democrats that I've seen give speeches that I didn't have a reaction of, like, yeah, but what about when you did this, you effer?
Oh, interesting. Right, interesting. It's going to, at this point, and I've talked to other progressives who will say, you know, they're progressive first and then Democrat second, obviously. They're not even Democrat, most of them. They're just progressive and had disappointment with President Obama on numerous issues. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren hit some good points last night that I think would have appealed to true progressives. I mean, that was real. I was like, wow, talking about banks and billionaires and Wall Street. And I'm like, that was substance. I did like and I did appreciate Bill Clinton, even though he went long. Talked about substance and not just this emoting and not just about moving us on emotion to the point where he was professorial. And I like Mayor Castro's speech was nice, but, you know, Bill Clinton didn't talk at us. He was like talking with us. It was like actually a conversation.
I mean, look, nobody gives a speech, you know, sort of like functionally better than Bill Clinton. The problem I had with Castro's speech was that he, although he did a good job of chastising Mitt Romney for not appreciating the advantages that he had, he didn't acknowledge, which I thought was really good, but he didn't acknowledge that in some respects, by virtue of having success, you have had a tremendous amount of luck. And so this notion about everybody's got to pull their themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, there are some people who actually can't. And that's just the reality of the world. So, you know, rather than seeing it all in this sort of like you are morally defective if you don't have the capacity to bring yourself up by your bootstraps, or ignoring the fact that there are some people who can't. You know, it's like
people have America's Got Talent, don't they, Sam? Those people have American Idol. And so you think you can dance? No?
But, I mean, but you know, it reminds me of like... I guess I can say this right now because we're in the post show, maybe, and I don't know. I don't want my father-in-law to hear this, but like I've been like I went skiing with him once, where he's like, "Come down to the Black Diamond Trail," and I'm like, I'm a little rusty. I don't go very often anymore. You know, as a kid I did, and when I was younger, and you know, but since I've had a child myself, and you know, we don't have the cash to go on, you know, taking ski trips and whatnot, and so I'm just out of practice.
Right.
And he's like, come on. Like, you know what? I may just not have, it's not just a question of will. It's, you know, there's a mountain there. I don't have the skills. And, you know, it's just sort of like that attitude I find to be somewhat problematic. You know what? There's some people who, they're just not suited to go down the Black Diamond Trail. They're suited to go down the Blue Square Trail. And, society should still make sure that they have the same opportunities, at the very least, in some respects, not necessarily the same outcomes, but close. There should be a minimum amount of outcomes that is there. So you know, that's why I say single payer healthcare for all. Just put everybody at that baseline, you know, instead of the baseline of whether or not you were lucky to be born in a certain place or lucky to have parents who
right.
had a certain amount of perseverance or whatnot. It's not just about material gifts. We have genetic gifts, and that doesn't mean that, you know, just because I'm a strapping young lad doesn't mean that I am more deserving of health care than somebody else.
Well, I agree with you 100% on the idea of the same opportunities for people and the whole, you know.
And partially outcome.
Leveling the playing field, but that's what it's about. Giving people opportunity, but also empowering them, giving them opportunity and being able to afford college in this climate. I perform a lot of colleges, and I cannot believe the fees. I mean, you know, if I have a child, they better be good at sports because there's no way I'm going to, they're never going to afford college.
That's what I'm trying to work on with my daughter right now.
How is she any good in any sports? Is there any sports?
No, she's athletic. It's good.
Thank God for that. Or really smart. You know, you got to do one or the other.
That's not happening.
And, okay, so, I mean, she's your child.
Sports.
But
yeah.
She's
probably funny. I'm not deluded enough to say, like, there's not, let me put it this way. There's not going to be an academic scholarship.
But she's the heir to the podcast empire.
Now, that may happen because she likes to talk. She came up to the office the other day and she looked at Matt. She's pretty funny, too. She looked at Matt and Michael and she's like, okay, bye, ladies. 7 years old.
She's going to have a reality show on TLC. Have you watched that Honey Boo Boo thing? I mean,
no, I haven't. I don't even know what it is.
What don't be against the money, Sam. I mean, the hundreds of thousands of dollars an episode the kids are making. You're out there pimping your kid. Okay, I get it. Not good. You don't feel good as a parent, but the money makes you all feel a little better, doesn't it? And
I'll do it.
I know.
All right, so Dean, give me the cities you're in right now because we're going to jump.
This weekend, Portland, Saturday, Sunday, Seattle. In 2 weeks from now, Sacramento and San Francisco. Then I'll be in Boston, Chicago, D.C., and New York. And, you know, deanofcomedy.com is the website. I hope people come out. All the tickets are very economical, like $20, $25 at the most, top, and no service charge, like using as little cheap service providers as possible so people come out and always have a couple opening acts. And it will be fun. It'll be about politics, about 50, 60%, and the rest about everything else, about being Arab and Islamophobia and pop culture and stuff. But if you like politics and you're progressive, you're probably going to like the show. If not, it's my fault.
I can't imagine there's anybody listening who doesn't, at the very least, like politics. Dean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Sam. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks, we've got to take a break, head into the better half of the program. And let me just take this time to say become a member. I got an email from somebody yesterday who said, I've been trying out your show. I don't like this whole thing where you call me a freeloader. So I'm going to stop listening. I wrote back, bye. Look, folks, if you can't handle me saying you're a freeloader, maybe it's you just can't handle the truth. I'm quite aware that we make the show for free. And I'm sort of teasing.
Many a truth in jest.
But even still, I'm just joking around with you. No, I mean, look. Nobody's forcing you to listen to the show, buddy. Don't listen to it.
Well, I'm not going to listen to the show anymore. I don't like that 20 seconds at the end where you say the word freeloader. That offends me.
Give me a break. Seriously? There are some people who I want to, like, just permanently exclude their capacity to ever listen to the show. I want to ban them from anything, from everything. Just go listen to NPR, dude. You think you're getting the full news? Go listen to NPR. You know why they don't call you a freeloader? Because they're underwritten by corporations. That's why. Corporations pay them to make you feel good about yourself. And I won't do that. Corporations pay them to make you feel good about yourself and then turn around and tell you that you smell. You should buy their underarm deodorant. Or that your breath is bad. You should buy their Scope or their Listerine, right? What are you looking at me like that for? See, it doesn't work that way?
You probably should buy Scope and Listerine, but I get your point.
Not underarm deodorant, though. Is that what you're saying? I'm a little sparing with it. Because I don't want to get Alzheimer's. I know you can get it without the aluminum, but you know what? If God meant us, and I mean God, because I believe we were intelligently designed. So if our underarms smell, it's because God wants it to. All right, this is getting weird. I'll see you in the better half.
Donate your account, iTunes, all that good stuff. Sam was too busy talking about Scope.